All right, for the purposes of the podcast, it is, and for other purposes, it is the 6th of December. This is the second to last in-class class of Privacy in the Digital Age. Remember that there will be shortly an online presentation for you to watch and enjoy regarding international privacy law. But tonight, I want to at least introduce you to some of the issues of cybercrime and the privacy issues, and both the sort of personal privacy issues and the related law enforcement privacy issues on cybercrime. Please remember that Thursday night's class, as we go through our second of these double weeks, is for you. It is for you to ask questions. I will post the remaining PowerPoints, the remaining podcasts, either before I leave tonight or first thing tomorrow. Please, at least, if you haven't already begun your review of them, please do so. Take a look at the chapters that I've posted. I'll try to link to the other drafts that are out there. I'm not nearly as far as I'd like. Come with questions about the material, about particular situations we've discussed, things that aren't quite clear, things you'd just like to have explained again. I would love to have enough substantive questions from you to fill the class period. So please take advantage of that. As always, we're going to start with some updates. And this was an interesting overview of how to take a lot of the legal rights to privacy that we've been studying, beginning with the Brandeis and Warren article, and throughout the entire semester, and turn them into functional, actionable suits. And so this is a piece from Forbes from last week. As the writer points out, there are specific requirements for any case to have standing, that the harm must be concrete, particularized, actual and imminent, traceable to the defendant's actions, and likely redressed by a favorable decision. That gets to, those are the factors that Supreme Court jurisprudence shows make something justiciable, able to be effectively dealt with by the courts. And so what this article discusses are the many lawsuits, and some of which we've raised in class this semester, like the Facebook tracking and some of the Friends Finder feature and other things that attempt to raise privacy issues. So, and seeing how the courts are showing some skepticism from these tort claims, at least in federal court, with regard to how online privacy has been or has not been violated. And so when I post the PowerPoint, the link will be there, but I think it's worth looking at this article. There were a few developments in Europe, and this leads into the class that I'm going to be recording. As you will see from that lecture, Europe's framework for privacy protection is not only substantially different from that of the United States, but substantially more intense. The requirements are greater. The European Union has mandated specific legal obligations that must be put into place in all of the EU member states. with regard to data protection, which we'll get to in a minute. And now, in a new EU effort, we have a methodology trying to, and this appears to be somewhat of a self-regulatory methodology, which is unusual for Europe, where 28 tech companies have agreed to joined into a coalition to make a better and safer internet for children, to try to give parents greater control for how children are communicated to and with online. So just as we have these discussions with regard to COPPA, with regard to some of the other tracking legislation and tracking issues, so too is Europe dealing with this. And as we have here, actually evoking, or rather involving, private companies, not just governments, in making that happen. And finally, and Joel, if I just clicked on this again by mistake, do you have Joel sent this to me, and I appreciated it, and asked him to maybe discuss this in greater detail. And this goes to the overall data protection directive that was initially adopted in 1995. Do you have you gotten into this enough to help summarize what's in this piece and what's going on?
Just basically the EU is going to, like next month, they're having some quote-unquote sweeping proposals about their privacy issues, where basically it's like multinational, I mean, companies that are huge that have about, say them like 250 million euro whatever a year, they're going to be affected. They have to redo their privacy issues because of a lot of data protection breaches. So they're going to be issuing all these new regulations out there. So companies with more than like 250 employees have to dedicate staff to like data protection issues. And it's going across the whole EU. So it's going to be affecting, it's probably just about every company that's out there.
Right. And the size of the fines. Which I think it must be revenue, not profit, but
right,
revenue. So imagine 5% of global revenue as a fine.
Yeah.
It puts into sharp perspective the scale, really the minute comparatively scale of the fines that we see from the Federal Trade Commission. As this article, which is from the Financial Times, suggests, the size of these fines could be billions of euros for if companies are found to mishandle personal data of customers, suppliers, or of their own employees. Think about how we've looked at all those categories. Europe really does take a different approach. It is an approach driven by much greater fears of abuse of personal information, much less trust for businesses to do the quote-unquote right thing. And will be worth watching. And certainly, as you say, every company. So this is a very real challenge for your clients. It could very well. There was not quite a privacy issue, but also looking at some of the differences between European law and American law, there was an article the other day about how e-books are doing less well in Europe. And part of that, and it's actually a law that applies not only to European companies but American companies, is that Europe imposes value-added tax on downloadable content, which could be up to 15 to 18%. But there are, in fact, tax breaks for printed books. So in Europe, it is much less expensive to buy an equivalently priced printed book than an ebook. That EVAT, that e-value-added tax law, applies to whichever company, whichever seller is selling into Europe. And while most U.S. companies selling downloadable content into Europe are probably not collecting that tax, they are, at some sense, accruing that liability. I mean, you do have to keep a view of what overseas laws, whether it's data protection law or otherwise, might impact your client because it has chosen to use the internet as a business medium. Now, today we're talking about cybercrime. And cybercrime can be many things. Francis is just not even looking. I put up a cute kitten picture. No. All right. A lot of sort of graphical evocations. This is a little frightening, actually. The idea of viruses in medical technology, considering that we've had examples of malicious software intrusions into power systems, into nuclear plants, into a lot of other things. The idea of how, and we have an increasing number of radiation devices, X-ray machines, and the like, MRI machines that are networked to send their materials, their scans elsewhere. This is not so far-fetched. For that matter, if you really want to worry yourselves, do a quick news search of the computer security issues of commercial aircraft, all of which have networks, and many of which have networks that include both the flight systems and the entertainment systems, the flight monitoring systems. There was a recent piece, I wonder if I can find it, I think it was 747s, let's see, the older story. Maybe. I'm not going to find it now. I'm not going to find it now, but there was a recent article that I saw about, again, how aircraft are have Linux networks, and the firewalls in the Linux network of the airplane were not sufficient, and one could go right through them. Kind of frightening. So the idea of medical systems, of other things we kind of need to keep working so we don't die. There have been hacks of automobiles. There was a dealer, and I may have mentioned this, that had installed disabling systems, remote disabling systems, in its vehicles. And a disgruntled employee, I think the story went, triggered them. And all these cars just stopped, middle of intersections. And this is talking about how the inventor of the web protocol never saw all of this crime coming, which is true. So philosophically, what's a crime? Anyone want to quickly venture a definition as to what a crime is? Is this another thing we know when we see it? What is a crime? We're in a law school. We study justice and stuff. You, I think, took criminal procedure, right?
I don't know.
Criminal?
I don't know.
What does that mean? An breach of contract is an unlawful act. Is that a crime? It is a violation of, it is an act that violates a law. Sure it is. We have two kinds of laws, don't we? Right. What are, what makes something covered by criminal as opposed to civil? What would you, in your own... Well, statutory in the sense, they're both statutes, right? This is a philosophical discussion. It really is. What is a crime? A crime can be defined as an offense against a social norm, sufficiently egregious that it's not just a bad thing, but it's a crime. It may be defined as serious damage to person or property. But some things are criminal, some things aren't. Defamation can be incredibly psychologically harmful, but it may not be criminal. Some people would describe a crime as those things that would mandate the perpetrator being isolated from society. That a person who performs this act is so far out of the norm that he or she must be evicted, excluded, either actually tossed out or confined to keep away from society. And there are other possibilities. Some things are seen as common. That there are some acts that in most societies, in most cases, would rise to the level of crimes. Like what? What act is almost always a crime? No matter where you are. What? Murder. Intentional, personal removal of life from another human being. Except what? In all circumstances, is killing another person murder and therefore criminal? No, of course not. Justifiable homicide, capital punishment, military service. Or certainly if you look at, you know, the Nazi law, murder of a significant portion of its population, or rather killing them, was not considered a crime at all. In fact, it was a legal requirement. Many cases, slaves, when killed, that's a property act. It is not a human act. Same with theft. Some societies, theft is a crime, most, not all, and so on. There are some societies where a woman behind the wheel of a car driving is a crime. We laugh, but it's true. There are some societies where eight people in a room without a government monitor is a crime. Criticizing the government may be a crime. There really aren't truly universal definitions. But it's really the severity, the away from the norm. In Ray Bradbury's Fahrenheit 451, having a book was criminal. Because it was so far away from the norms that society wanted. So why do we have criminal law, this category of our legal system, for these so exceptional acts? One reason is to let people know what they're not supposed to do, right? Here and no further. Beyond this, you have crossed that boundary into offensiveness, seriousness, isolation requiring acts. Criminal law may serve the purpose of establishing deterrence, because criminal law generally comes with some kind of consequences. The consequences, in theory, are so heinous that they will deter people from committing the acts that generate, that will cause those consequences to be put in place. Criminal law, by its very existence and functionality, can be seen as enhancing security, not physical security, but emotional security. Enhancing people's comfort in their lives, in their ability to live without problem. And there are, again, other areas. So that's sort of the philosophy of criminal law. So what's a cybercrime? I mean, it is a separate area of... It may be a separate area of law. It is certainly a separate area of law enforcement. The Nassau Police has a cybercrime unit. So I think to the Suffolk Police, the U.S. Attorney's Office, the New York City Police Department, they have cybercrime units. So what makes a cybercrime? Could be a computer is used in the commission of the crime. Although, in most circumstances, being bonked over the head with a heavy laptop is probably not a cybercrime, unless the laptop is the victim's and data are damaged. Using the internet to commit the crime. Data theft, identity theft, cyber stalking, fraud. There are crimes that can be committed over a network. Cybercrime may also involve the criminal procedure side of it. Using computers to investigate a crime. You may have a crime against information. We have to have these new definitions because it is possible to steal something while leaving it there. You cannot steal a car and have it remain in the parking lot. You can't drive away with a stolen car. Well, you wouldn't. A thief cannot drive away with a stolen car and the car is still there. It doesn't work in the real world. But a thief can certainly steal millions of credit card numbers from the database they are in, and they're still there. It's a crime against information. Damaging it, copying it without permission, spreading it around. All these sort of strangeness. Why is it that there needs to be a definition of cybercrime? Well, one of the theories is, particularly when it comes to using a computer as an instrumentality or a network, you see sometimes that increases the potential sentence. Because, first of all, because it's easier to commit a cybercrime than an in-person crime. And since there is a lower bar of difficulty, the legal system tries to put a higher punishment for greater deterrence. To steal a million credit cards is hard. To steal a million credit card numbers, fairly easy. Some of the legal challenges are definitional. When there is a law against theft and credit card numbers are copied and utilized, is that theft? Well, it may have the same ultimate result as if the credit cards themselves were stolen. But the definition may require, I mean, think about conversion, the sort of tort equivalent of theft. Right? It's taking someone's property and getting value from it. All of that jurisprudence implies that the original owner doesn't have it anymore. But it wouldn't mean necessarily conversion. There was a whole set of cases on fighting spam using the doctrine of trespass to chattels. Going in and using someone's personal property in a way that made it harder for the owner to use it effectively. The idea being the computers that were processing the spam were slowed down, made less efficient, etc. But it was a stretch. There, one of the seminal cases about cybercrime in New York involved whether someone who watched a commuter punch in a long-distance code at a Port Authority phone, payphone, memorized the numbers, wrote them down, and went around basically offering for payment to allow people to use this number to make international phone calls. Essentially stole the phone card number by watching it being dialed. And the judge had to wrestle with this question. There was no physical, the card that the number was embossed upon was still in the commuter's wallet. Person didn't steal the card, he stole the number. Was that theft? They had to wrestle with this. So there are times that just the definitions don't work well, even if it seems like they should. The formal definitions, yeah. Right. So either, but there too, the definitions, law is reactive. Law enforcement, rather, is reactive. Law enforcement takes what is set as criminal law today and applies it as it's written, as it has been interpreted. If what's now on the books can't quite be stretched far enough, the perp may walk. When David Lamacchia was an MIT student, put up hundreds upon hundreds of dollars of commercial software on a server and allowed it to be copied for free, for the hell of it. He was brought up on wire fraud charges, and the judge dismissed the charges because it wasn't wire fraud, it was infringement. And criminal infringement at the time, the way the words were written, required that he would be making money because nobody else had ever bothered to steal things without making money, to copy things without selling them because it was expensive. It didn't cost him anything, so he just did it. They had to change the law to talk about commercial value instead of actual profit because suddenly technology made it possible to copy without cost. And distribute without cost. The words may not work. Just because something is seen as horrible, disgusting, kind of like that website I showed you, it may still not be a crime. Perhaps it should be. Perhaps in the next legislative session there will be a new law on the books that describes this new activity that's like murder or criminal harassment or something, but does it fit that definition, or the definition may be expanded. Sometimes we need new laws. Who is the victim can be difficult. When this credit card was, when this phone card number was stolen, for example, who was the victim? Was it the commuter? He didn't even know. Well, he was potentially responsible for the bill, but that would depend on the contract. If a credit card number, as opposed to a debit card number, is stolen and used, who's the victim? Who's the victim if a credit card number is stolen and used?
Person whose credit card is used almost not at all.
right? Maximum of $50 by federal statute exposure. And most bank contracts, I think, at this point eliminate even the $50. The victim is the issuing bank. And potentially the merchant that sold the goods if the merchant won't get paid. It's between the issuing bank and the merchant to work out. So when a credit, but if a credit, if money is stolen out of a wallet, the victim is the muggee. Defining who the victim is, who might have the right to press charges. If data are copied, or if a computer is damaged, who's the victim? Where was the crime committed? Bruce Sterling famously said that cyberspace was the place where telephone calls took place. When you're talking with someone on the phone, you're face-to-face, essentially, in cyberspace. If a Russian malicious hacker named Ivanov is sitting in Russia, breaking into a database of credit cards in Connecticut, where does the crime take place? Russia? Connecticut? Cyberspace? The Matrix? What does the law say? And of course, where it takes place often has very important jurisdictional disputes, which law applies. Just to give you, again, this is all by way of introduction, the major federal statute with regard to computer crime per se is the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act, 18 U.S.C. 1030. It was first enacted in 1986. As you can imagine, it has changed. It has needed to change. Often, and when I teach cybercrime, one of the things that we do is go over many of the cases that showed how technology had outpaced the words in the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act, which generally led to an amendment to the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act. If one goes to Westlaw and looks at this statute, you know, where at the bottom of the annotations, it says how many times the statute has been amended. This one has quite a paragraph. And then the Patriot Act came in and added further to those kinds of things. But, and I'm not even going to look at it now because it's beyond the scope, but it's significantly broader than it used to be. And here, just to let you know the sort of general structure of the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act, most of its non-Patriot Act offenses have two elements. The first element is that the alleged perpetrator accessed a computer without authorization or exceeding authorization. If you have a password or you have an account on a computer but you find a way around the restrictions and you get to information to which you are not entitled, that might be considered exceeding authorization. But there's almost always an and. Merely going beyond your authorization to get into a computer, or merely getting into a computer without authorization, is not enough to count as a crime under this law. There is generally an and the and may be used it to commit a fraud or damage data or stole something, did some other act. There are some interesting provisions about trafficking and stolen passwords as well, but in the malicious hacking, criminal hacking sense, it's generally got into a computer without authorization or through exceeding authorization and did something else. And it's worth looking at. Not so much for the benefit of this class, but just to see how that ends up getting defined in your copious free time. Of course, the other relevant statute when it comes, or the most relevant statute, as we've seen, when it comes to law enforcement efforts in cyber and non-cyber crime, has to do with the Constitution, the Fourth Amendment, to which we've looked already, right? Being free of the right of the people to be secure in their persons, houses, papers, and effects against unreasonable searches and seizures shall not be violated, and no warrant shall issue but upon probable cause, supported by oath or affirmation, and particularly describing the place to be searched and the persons or things to be seized. All of these provisions end up being relevant when it comes to privacy and cybercrime. So what are the Fourth Amendment issues here? Just to keep in mind, I know this is not a cybercrime class, but when dealing with law enforcement and privacy, digital privacy, one, you need to know, does the Fourth Amendment come in at all? Or is it purely a civil matter? Well, if there's no government, there's no Fourth Amendment. What's a search and a seizure when it comes to data? Is it reading the data? Is it making a copy of the data? Is it changing the data in some way? How do the existing exceptions under constitutional jurisprudence to the warrant requirement come into effect here? Exigent circumstances. What would be considered exigent circumstances with regard to data? Generally, an exigent circumstance would be the house is burning down, I have to go in, or the criminal's about to set fire to the house, or the suspect walked into a bathroom, closed the door, I was worried he or she was going to flush the evidence down the toilet, so I went in and opened the door and watched and grabbed it before it could go away. So what is an exigent circumstance when it comes to computer data? It's something to think about. Well,
like you go in and the person's going to wipe out everything from the hard drive or copy everything to a flash drive or something.
Could be, right? Data are ephemeral. The power's going down. The laptop battery, you know, whatever. He's about to log off. There are sort of, you can think of circumstances that are exigent circumstances only for this type of context. What is consent? Who is entitled to consent? If your email is here on Turo's system, may Turo consent to reading your email for a law enforcement, and therefore no warrant is necessary. If you share your computer with a partner, with a spouse, may he or she consent to, and which of your files does he or she have the right to consent to law enforcement without needing a warrant? Search incident to an arrest. Already arrested, is it permissible to look at the laptop on the suspect's person? And to what extent? Border searches. There's a really bizarre case just in terms of how far this goes, it kind of combines border searches, et cetera, that someone was stopped at the border and it was perceived, seen that there were movie cameras, then the movies were watched, and there were images of children, and then the computer that the person had was searched and there was child porn. It was sort of this odd chain of circumstances, but border searches generally have much lower Fourth Amendment protection, including of laptops. And government workplace searches, we've seen, depending on the context, if it's not law enforcement per se, but it's workplace required, as we discussed, there may be no warrant necessary. So we're talking about data privacy, and data protection. And it raises the question of protection from seizure by law enforcement. At what level of protection is there? What requirements must there be? But what is seizure? Existing jurisprudence, existing cases, the definition of seizures has to do with some meaningful interference with an individual's possessory interest in the individual's property. In the physical world, you can see that. You took my car. I cannot drive it because it's sitting in the impound lot behind a locked gate. You took my wallet. I can't use it to find money to buy anything. You took my ID. That's seizure. You made a copy of the data on my laptop. You, the police officer, have them. I still have them. Has my possessory interest in my property, the property being the information, been meaningfully interfered with? Oh. They didn't think about this when they came up with this definition. Because it was impossible to seize someone's stuff, and they still have it. Right? Or they can still fully use it. I mean, if you think about the joy of, you know what a boot is for in traffic enforcement? Anyone ever been introduced to the boot? And I don't mean something on a foot. You know what I'm talking about? Anybody not know what I'm talking about? Feel free to say no. We all know, yes? Everyone knows what a boot is? You're looking vaguely quizzical. All right? You know, traffic cop, they don't bother ticketing. They see your car. They don't tow it. They just put this metal thing on the wheel so you can't drive it. That is a seizure. It's still there. But your possessory interest has been meaningfully interfered with. Because you can't drive the darn thing. So, if they take your laptop, but you can still get all of your stuff because it's online, have they seized it? Yes, it's your physical property, but if the function isn't missing, has it been seized? In the way of a meaningful interference with your possessory interest in terms of using it. If they copy your data, have they been seized? They read your data. Has your possessory interest been interfered with? You might argue that if the data, the information being looked at as a trade secret, and by virtue of it being read by a law enforcement person and getting out into the public record, the value of the trade secret is now gone, perhaps. You know, they copy a file, they copy a whole drive. Does that change one's interest? On that topic, I came across this story from about a week and a half ago. And this gets into how questions of consent and questions of police procedures. So, as we've seen over the semester, internet service providers and online services have a lot of information about us. Information that is of great value, potentially, to law enforcement officials. It turns out that many of these providers have drafted and shared with law enforcement agencies guidelines as to what information they have and what legal process is needed to compel or permit the service provider to release it. I thought it would be worth a quick look at. This is Facebook's law enforcement guidelines. This is meant for law enforcement officers. So, lest you be under any illusion that the big commercial services and service providers are on, I don't want to say on users' side, but oppose in any meaningful way law enforcement requests, let me dissuade you of that illusion. Because what Facebook does here is give a step-by-step process. Quote Facebook, "We disclose account records solely in accordance with our terms of service and applicable law, including the Stored Communications Act, about which we will speak in a moment. Under the SCA, a valid subpoena issued in connection with an official criminal investigation is required to compel the disclosure of basic subscriber records. A court order issued under Section 2703D is required to compel the disclosure of certain records or other information pertaining to the account, not including the contents of the communications. And a search warrant issued under the procedures described in the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure or equivalent state warrant procedures upon a showing of probable cause is required to compel the stored compel the disclosure of the stored contents of any account." So what we have here is a level, and there, I have a chart in a couple minutes, a level of legal process needed, or that Facebook says you must do in order to open that lock. So what are the locks? Basic subscriber records, name, length of service, credit card information, email addresses, and a recent login IP address, if available, only needs a subpoena. Other records, such as message headers and IP addresses, and basic subscriber records, may require a court order issued under this particular statute. And if police officers, the law enforcement officials, wish to see the contents of messages or photos or other kinds of content, it requires a search warrant. So you don't even have to guess. Facebook tells you. International legal requirements, account preservation, emergency requests. In responding to a matter involving imminent harm to a child or risk of death or serious physical injury to any person and requiring disclosure of information without delay, a law enforcement official may obtain an emergency form by contacting us at records@facebook.com. Important note, we will not review or respond to messages sent to this email address by non-law enforcement officials. And lest you wonder about the privacy policy, we report, that's Facebook, all apparent instances of child exploitation appearing on our site from anywhere in the world to the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children, including content drawn to our attention by government requests. So Facebook has made itself a reporter. Data retention availability, form of request that tells you exactly how to do this, user consent, notification, does a user need to be notified? Law enforcement officials who believe that notification would jeopardize an investigation should obtain an appropriate court order or other process establishing that notice is prohibited. Law enforcement officials may also request non-disclosure if notice would lead to risk of harm. Testimony, Facebook does not provide expert testimony support. So if you want to be, if you know a lot about Facebook, here's a job for you. You could be the expert witness. Cost reimbursement, etc. So here is, I'm sorry. Do you know what the mailing address for these is? 18 Hacker Way. Yeah. Look! Now it could be named for somebody named Hacker. I just think that's funny. Be the first of your friends to like this. So there you have it, folks. That is how Facebook responds to information requests. And this article gives you some other information. How do we know this? Because it was leaked. A data dump from Anonymous. Remember Anonymous? The hacker that has gone after a lot of stored stuff and put it online. Did that already. All right. Reminding you about government workplace searches, as we've said, if their law enforcement warrant requirements are in place, if it's not for law enforcement, if there's a reasonable expectation of privacy, that gets balanced against the workplace needs similarly, but perhaps more stringently than would be the case for private workforces. We discussed some of this previously. So, there is this information. It may include personally identifiable information or other data. It may rise to the level of needing a warrant. What issues, then, are raised in the context of seeking those warrants? These searches can be physical and electronic. It may require a police officer to actually go to a computer and work on it, or simply get access to the data remotely. As we've seen, if the police are seeking a user's Facebook messages, that warrant doesn't go to the user or doesn't have to go to the user to look at the user's personal computer. It can go to Facebook on Hacker Drive or Hacker Way. And yet the search can be done electronically through Facebook's servers. The warrant would likely have to cover both, particularly if a laptop, if a personal computer or computing device is being searched, right? For the police to say, I have a warrant to look at your laptop. There's a warrant to look at your laptop. Black. A silver keyboard. Very nice. The warrant doesn't say, and look at the data on your laptop. Right? I can look at what's on the screen, the fact that you're looking at your email while in class. But the warrant has to include both in order for both to be permitted. Terminology. I have a warrant here to search your computer. This is a phone. Can't look at this. Is this a computer? Well, depends. Is it a personal computer? I have a warrant to search your hard drive. Oh, it's over there. Hold on while I take this USB stick out of it so you can look at the hard drive. It's not a hard drive. It's a USB stick. Getting the words right matters, right? What did our Fourth Amendment say? Anyone remember? Particularly describing the place to be searched and the persons or things to be seized. Particularity can be difficult in when the police officer or the judge is unfamiliar with computers. This is not so easy. Right. Storage media. Where is it? What is it called? Data format. I've seized your hard drive. Unfortunately for me, you've decided to use a 30-year-old operating system that you are the only person. You have a, you, It turns out to be an Apple II format. I've got it, but I cannot read it. May you be compelled, or it's encrypted. May you be compelled to decrypt it. If files have been deleted, and in case you don't know this or have forgotten, let me reiterate. Deleting a file on a typical computing device does not make the information go away. All it does, and the reason you can delete things so quickly, is there is a notation made in the computer's filing system that the space taken up by that file may be used for something else when necessary. Until it becomes necessary, that file sits. That's how you can undelete things. Sometimes it will be an option, you know, you delete it and then hit undo. It's back. Or you get a freely available tool that reads through a computer's hard drive or storage device and sees what information is still sitting there, eligible for being overwritten, but hasn't been overwritten yet. This is forensics 101. It's very easy to do. But if that's the intention, the warrant probably needs to describe that intention. Does a warrant entitle a police officer to undelete files? Maybe, maybe not. Well, how would you define stored on the hard drive? How would you define, you know, documents? Well, it's not a document anymore. It can't be read. You have to recover it, or it's partially there. The other danger here is that computer data are not particularly hardy. Neither are computer systems. And setting aside any claims for property damage against the police department, a poorly managed suspect's computer, or a computer belonging to a suspect, may find itself wiped, useless, whatever. There's the classic help desk back in the day era of the floppy disk, where the user is complaining that the floppy disk didn't work anymore. And it turns out that the user had used a magnet to stick the floppy disk to the refrigerator to keep it safe. Floppy disks are just, and for that matter, hard disks are just platters with little particles on them deposited and read by magnets. If you wish to mess them up, you rub a particularly powerful magnet over them and you can largely randomize them. So this isn't like searching a desk drawer. If you search the wrong thing in the wrong way on a computer, you can erase everything. You'd have to look at the cases. How have the courts read this in the real world? If you say drawer, do you have to say which drawer? If you say closet, which closet? If you say computer, how specific? What's the danger? What if the warrant is insufficiently particular? What happens? What?
You're not going to get that
evidence. Why not?
Because you can only go to certain things, you know, say somewhere else than what's on the warrant.
What if you go there anyway?
Why
not?
Because you're going above and beyond what the warrant says.
Which violates what? The Fourth Amendment. Which then evokes which rule? The exclusionary rule. Fruit of the poisonous tree. That's the risk. If the warrant is deemed after the fact, is challenged, for being insufficiently particular. And that challenge is upheld. All of that information, right? All of the evidence gathered, thrown out, inadmissible, done. You had a question?
Yeah, it's sort of along those lines. Like in a search warrant, if you're able to search the house for a shotgun, you couldn't necessarily look in a film canister or something of that nature. If you're searching for kiddie porn on a computer, could you open every doc file and...
I don't know.
Wouldn't that be a legitimate concern,
that? It certainly would, bless you. On the other hand, if you're looking for pornography, it may be a photo embedded in a document. Right? There are, again, this is not the cybercrime case class. In the cybercrime class, in the book, in the cases, there are a lot of these kinds of parsing. Who owns the device? If it's a shared computer, but the files, like my wife and I each have a login on her computer. So could she legally consent to have the police search my files if she never has access to those? She doesn't, we don't mix. It's not so clear, right? The files, I may have a reasonable expectation in the files that requires a warrant. The physical computer, if I stuck a note on it, we share the computer. But unless we intermix those files, two roommates, each has his own set of drawers. They share a room, but one roommate is not generally owner of the drawers, user of the drawers. It's not so clear. So a lot of this has to do with, right, a shot. If what is one is looking for is a shotgun, and the shotgun can't be broken down into its component parts, a little container will not be able to hold a shotgun. It is beyond the scope of the warrant. If one is looking for child pornography, and there are files that cannot contain child pornography by their nature, and I'm not sure what they would be, then those might go beyond the scope of the warrant. The case that we talked about briefly the other week about the state employee whose computer was looked at because there was a suspicion he was running a tax preparation business on the side, and guess what? He was running a tax preparation business on the side. What the court... One of the factors that the court focused on in approving that workplace search, and it wasn't criminal, was that what the employer did was look at the list of the names of the files. Not within the contents, but just the names. And enough of the names were, you know, taxprepsoftware.exe or whatever it is, that then gave sufficient cause to go further. But it was because in the first permissible top-level search, there was this indication that there was more. Do not take anything that I'm telling you tonight as practice guidelines for either drafting or challenging warrants. There are other classes here for that. I'm simply raising the point that, particularly when it comes to issues of stored data, in a variety of devices and form factors and formats, and being fragile, the warrant drafting and execution and search processes are fraught with potential peril. As we saw from the Facebook guidelines, one of the things that Facebook may be willing to give up in response to a subpoena or a court order, etc., is the IP address. And as we've said, I think in the past, IP addresses can be somewhat personally identifiable information. They can at least help determine the owner of a computer or an account utilized for something. And we've talked about what IP addresses are and how you have to track them to specific dates and times because they are reissued. I think we've gone over those issues, right? In the past, we don't need to rehearse them. I just put it in there because it's relevant here, too. As I think I mentioned when discussing the Electronic Communications Privacy Act, which is both civil and criminal, it comes up again here because it is criminal. We have these three sections to it, the Wiretap Act, the Pen Register Statute, and, as Facebook mentioned, the Stored Communications Act. These set up civil responsibilities, that is, expectations of privacy generally in stored data and in stored communications and in transmitted communications. This is the federal statute that establishes the general expectation of privacy. It provides, as I think we've already discussed previously, opportunities, legal opportunities for the network owners. We talked about this in the workplace context too, for the network owners to look at, monitor data in order to make sure their systems are running properly. But the other thing that these portions of the Electronic Communications Privacy Act do is give guidelines for law enforcement activities with regard to communications as they are happening, wiretaps or monitoring emails as they're going across, to subscriber and non-content information. Pen Register Statute covers things like numbers that are dialed, the header information in an email message, non-content, and then as it's being transmitted, and then the Stored Communications Act. Once a message has been transmitted, it is received, the legal structure through which law enforcement may or may not get access to that. And if you recall from the Facebook guidelines we looked at a few moments ago, for stored communications, for the contents of a message, right? What did Facebook say? Anybody remember what was required for the contents of a message or photos? It was more than a quarter. It was a warrant. Facebook said that it would not respond to a subpoena or a court order. It needed a warrant. And some of that comes out of the Stored Communications Act. And these are separate from constitutional protections. These set up specific requirements, process requirements, limitations. You have to do the constitutional analysis in any event. If it's police involved, the Constitution applies. But if police are involved, if state actors are involved, and we're talking about stored electronic communications, you also need to do the analysis of what this statute requires. So, hypothetically speaking, if in an exam the fact pattern was a cybercrime-related fact pattern, and if, for example, you were asked to counsel an internet service provider or a law enforcement official on the procedures through which that law enforcement official could get access to stored communications, emails or pictures sitting on a server, you'd say, well, this is a government actor. The Constitution and all constitutional obligations apply. But also, if this fits and if it's a picture, is it communications or not? Assuming it fits under the definitions in the Stored Communications Act, my client would also need to fulfill any of these requirements in order to legally have access to that information. This is not an either or. It may be a both. This is always relevant, the Fourth Amendment, to any police search or seizure. But if it's one of these types of things, communicate the contents of communications as they're happening, the address and other non-content parts of communications as they're happening, and communications that are stored, then these statutes come into effect as well. So we've talked about ECPA before. And this prospective, retrospective, content, non-content really boils down to, is it happening right now? That's prospective. That's right now. If it's what's being said, it's the Wiretap Act. If it's who's saying to whom and when, it's probably the Penn Register statute. If it's afterwards, then it is the Stored Communications Act. You take a look at some of these issues. They're really a little bit beyond this discussion. I put them in for just to give you some context. Oops. Just to introduce you to the categories, and we've seen some of this stuff. The Wiretap Act. Wiretaps. In process or afterwards? Now or before? Now. Stuff being said, or the stuff about who's saying it to whom? Content or non-content? Wiretaps. Content. These statutes are about, this is 18 U.S.C., it's part of federal criminal law, in-process communications and the content of those in-process communications. Think of a wiretap. Listening in when the mob boss is talking to his lieutenants. An actual tap of a phone wire. But the definitions have been expanded beyond telephone calls to email messages and the like. But we have definitions, like all statutes, you gotta look. The general prohibition on interception and disclosure. And the exclusion, if this is violated in evidence. And some of the exceptions. So the general principle is these communications may not be intercepted, and if they are, and they are, they may not be disclosed. And generally speaking, if they are, they may not be used as evidence. But here are the exceptions. When is interception authorized? That's 2516. And when is disclosure and use authorized? That's 2517. And these talk about both private rights, that is, service providers, your employer, etc., and the process of law enforcement. Let's see what Facebook was referencing. Facebook's actually only talking about stored communications. This doesn't discuss the issues of in process of wiretaps, but obviously Facebook would be subject to those requirements too. Just to give you a sense of where these cases go, O'Brien versus O'Brien. It was a divorce case. Wife installed spyware on her husband's computer, intercepted an online chat. He got an injunction prohibiting disclosure of future interception under the Wiretap Act. This is not law enforcement. Just to show you that these issues come up in civil actions too. She appealed the injunction, the judgment, and the inadmissibility in the divorce. He was chatting with a hussy. How do you know? I tapped his computer. Excluded. This was under a state law like the Wiretap Act. What did the court say? Here the question was whether they were intercepted or stored. If it was stored communications, That statute doesn't apply. You got to look somewhere else. What? Right?
In other words, stored because what I'm not following where the factual different distinctions were.
Two different laws.
No, I know the law differences. I'm not following the factual distinctions that the court was going to.
Well, I realize you haven't read the case. So the question was, how did she see these chats? If they were sitting on the computer after the fact and she read them, then the injunction, which was based on wiretapping, would not have applied. What did she do? She was watching it as she was typing it. Right? In real time. Her argument was, no, it wasn't in transmission. It was stored on a screen after it was typed. It was in memory, which is can be considered, but not here. She was, because she was capturing these communications in real time, even though her argument was, I was reading them out of computer memory after he typed them. Therefore, it was a very small amount of time, but they were stored. Now, again, there is some basis in, for example, copyright. Different context. But one of the big crucial questions that had to be addressed when the courts were first looking at copyright issues and infringement of software was the requirement in all copyright laws that in order to be eligible for copyright, the creative expression must be embodied in something. It must be recorded, transcribed, somewhere permanent. Audio recordings, once they're recorded, are subject to copyright protection. Songs, once they're written down, and so forth. Software programs that only exist in a computer's memory, and they're not on a permanent physical disk, the courts actually had to address, is that considered an embodiment for this purpose? And the answer was yes. So there's some notion that once it's in memory, it's stored, but not for this purpose. So the former Mrs. O'Brien had luck in this circumstance. But I added this case just to show you these fine distinctions even in the civil actions. The definitions. Which law applies, stored or wiretap? Is it content or non-content? Again, parallel, just as the... So we saw this already. This is the... Yeah, we saw this. I must have duplicated the slide. Sorry about that. The pen register statute is the content, is the non-content stuff as it's being transmitted. Started for... A pen register was a device that you stuck on a phone line, and when a number was dialed, a pen would register what digits were dialed. That's a 7. That's a 9. You guys old enough to actually have dialed a phone? Anybody? Some of you? Do you know what I'm talking about? Maybe you had one of those little white plastic push ones with little eyes that you were a kid. You were like, why does it have a round thing on it? Trying to win radio contests in the dial phone era, very difficult. Can't tell you how many times. 2-1-2-9-5-5. My parents took an awfully long time to get touch tone, that's all I can say. Now, you're not talking about the content of the message. You're talking about the non-content stuff. So there are similar procedures, but they are less stringent. The concerns are lower. But we get into this interesting question of what is considered content. When I was discussing recently, I was discussing that telephone card copying and use case. Some of my students in my externship class were remembering the days of the collect call. when you wanted to get picked up or you wanted to give a message and you didn't want anybody to spend money. Maybe it was long distance, right? You know, this is a call from, please pick me up. Do you accept the charges? No. You know. Right? So consider. It just, believe me, we all tried to do it. Is that content or non-content? It would be considered part of the Penn Register statute. From, please pick me up. From, baby's fine. Right? But there was content. Similarly, how many times have you sent or received an email message that's just the subject line? You don't have to put all. That's all you wanted to say. Subject lines historically have been considered non-content and covered by the much less stringent Penn Register statute. What about geolocation information? You post a message to Facebook, which is covered by the warrant requirement, right? But if you have Facebook Places turned on and you're posting from a device that has a GPS chipset, your physical location is appended to that message. True of Twitter as well. It could be even true in photographs. Location embedded in the digital information, essentially the non-content stuff. But pretty substantive. The place where you're actually standing. This definition, content versus non-content, is very difficult. And Salve, who is a cyber law scholar, questions whether the distinction is even appropriate, whether non-content information, however you define it, is so much less sensitive. But you do see similar exceptions as to the Wiretap Act. For the Stored Communications Act, we're talking about once it's been received. And this sets the standards for governmental investigators' interactions with systems administrators. 2703 was, in fact, the statute to which Facebook refers in its guidelines here. 2703C2, 2703D. A little beyond the scope, but the statute differentiates between an electronic communication service and a remote computing service. I'm not even going to begin. You can take a look. But essentially, those systems that are primarily for communications fit under the electronic communication services definition. And those systems that enable communication as part of a broader range would be remote computing services. So, for example, the BlackBerry network. Pretty clear, meant for communications. Okay. Gmail. Is it a standalone thing or is it part of the Google service? Being able to send a message within, you know, you're playing Call of Duty because you don't have enough to do. And you're chatting with a fellow player. At that moment, communication is happening, but it's probably better defined that serve as a remote computing service. You have to look at the definitions. The laws are slightly different one from the other. So we see there's 2703, and you see that A, B, and C. 2703A is about general electronic communications. B and C are about remote computing services, and you have some various issues. This chart, which you can take a look at on the slides, is somebody else's chart basically trying to parse through different kinds of information, which law applies and when. I don't expect you to know this stuff. If you're curious, take a look. But in terms of which box, is it open email that's still sitting on a server? Is it a public provider as it's defined? Can it be disclosed voluntarily? Generally, no. If it's a non-public provider, perhaps. It may be like a network administrator. What do we need to get that disclosed for a public provider? A subpoena with notice or a search warrant. Non-public provider doesn't apply. And so on. Just, it's an interesting chart. In terms of how these cases play out, what happens if you get it wrong? This was a child porn case. Internet service provider got an anonymous call about having child porn at a particular IP address. It belonged to the Kennedys at that moment. Then the internet service provider reported the user to the Wichita police, turned around, got a court order to disclose the subscriber information. And there was an investigation, there was a search warrant, child porn found. Kennedy turned around and said that the subscriber information, the request, was not specific enough. The court order did not rise to the level of the requirement in 2703D for specificity. So what? If this were a warrant requirement under the Constitution, what would have happened to the evidence? Excluded, right? Warrant was insufficiently specific. Evidence obtained, thrown out. Fruit of the poisonous tree and all that good stuff. Right? And here, if this was thrown out, then the search warrant that was ultimately based upon what they found in the subscriber info should have also been thrown out. The conviction should have been overturned. But, says the court here, even though this was violated, suppression was not provided as a remedy. There might be a lawsuit, there might be damages, but this is not a constitutional obligation. This is a specific statute. As I said, in addition to constitutional protections, this was not at the warrant level. And even though the formal requirements of the statute weren't quite met, nevertheless, there was no suppression of that evidence. I recognize this stuff. There's a lot here. So let's try to really sum it up. When it comes to access to personally identifiable information, when it comes to access to messages that may be stored, credit card information and the like, we've seen over the semester the civil requirements with regard to those data. Here, though, we're looking at law enforcement. And of course, in true law enforcement, the Constitution is always in operation. If it is something that is defined as a search and a seizure by a governmental official, the Fourth Amendment and any state constitutional protections, we shouldn't forget, operates with all of its requirements for the search being reasonable, for the warrant being issued, for the warrant being specific, etc. And to the extent that what we are talking about is communications, either in process or stored, there are additional legal protections, additional legal requirements beyond, or as I say, additional, supplementing the constitutional obligations, even if it's not yet a search, even if it's not a seizure, for things such as, or even if it is, the requirements that are placed upon law enforcement to access messages in transit, wiretaps, to access address and other non-content, however we might define that, information as it's being sent, pen register statute. And then to get access to both the content and the non-content part of messages once they are stored. Bless you. Stored Communications Act. These statutes apply. And if you are counseling law enforcement or you are counseling a party that may be dealing with law enforcement, either as the alleged perpetrator or as the network owner, you need to be aware of and make your client aware of these additional protections. Now, a few final words on this. These are federal statutes, which means that in order for them to operate, you must be able to show jurisdiction. It's not very difficult when you're talking about communications to show jurisdiction. Anything on the internet, pretty well, whether or not it's sent within a state, evokes interstate commerce. And there are even cases that say when you're talking about child pornography, because there is an interstate market, it may evoke interstate commerce. But keep this in mind. If something is a file but has not been communicated, a document sitting on a computer, a warrant requirement may be there, but not the Electronic Communications Privacy Act. It's not communications. If a nasty law professor gives you a hypothetical about police seeking information on a computer, the first question you have to answer is it communications or not? There are cases, if it's not, ECPA doesn't apply because the big C isn't there. Don't get fooled by that stuff. There are federal cases, there's at least one that I have taught, where there was pornography on a computer, but federal officials didn't have jurisdiction. State officials did. Federal officials didn't have jurisdiction because they couldn't, I know, we have to go. We couldn't prove, they couldn't prove, it had been sent. It was just there. So you have to look at the facts to see if the law applies. Come with questions Thursday night. Hopefully it's less foggy tonight than yesterday, which was ridiculous. Have a good evening.